Good morning. Excuse me. So I was asked to along with Sujoy, to kind of motivate our reasons to be here, right? And as Bruce has already mentioned, our topic this summer is quite similar to a topic that we did a few years ago back in 2004. And so, yes, we were relating, you know, geochemical, geophysical heterogeneities in the deep Earth. Now, in my little presentation, I sort of the questions that we're going to be asking or that have been asked, and then sort of the problems that we have been embarking over the past 14 odd years are mainly focused in the mantle. But don't fret, we will also talk about the core, okay? So we could have called this CIDR 2004. And it turns out, and actually, if anybody's ever seen me give a talk in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, the next slide will look very familiar. And it's because my group actually works on this, okay? We actually are looking for heterogeneities, or we're looking at how heterogeneities influence the Earth and the evolution of the Earth. And so I would put up a slide like this, and I say, oh, okay, you know, how does the Earth evolve from, you know, essentially nearly all molten state during accretion, and then how has it evolved to what is now shown presently as something that is mostly solid and differentiated? And it's like, okay, this is a figure that, you know, is useful. However, it's a little vanilla, right? There are not a lot of heterogeneities in there. So I found another, you know, Google Images is quite, you know, nice for these kinds of things. And although this Earth is quite heterogeneous, and those boundaries don't look like they're quite in the right place, but you get the idea. Okay, so we're going to be looking at these geochemical, geophysical heterogeneities in the deep Earth all the way through. So what has changed over the past 14 years? So here is a photograph of the tutorial section of 2004, and you'll notice a few familiar faces. Actually, that's me. I was a postdoc, brand new postdoc. And there are several familiar faces actually in here that are in the room now. So unfortunately, Barbara's not here, but she has been very much active in this year's program as well. And Dan Shim was there. We also have Lars Stigshrud and Carolina. You know, you've seen him now. Bruce, Christine, I haven't seen Christine yet. Is she here yet? No. Okay. So Christine Hauser was also one of the tutorial participants, and Luis, and that's me. And hopefully I haven't missed anyone. But there are quite a few of us that are still around. So while it's a similar topic that we had investigated back in 2004, a few things have changed, and we've made some progress, maybe not as much as we'd like, but I wanted to sort of contrast what we sort of knew, or what we sort of thought back in 2004, as to what the new ideas have come up since. Okay. And so here are just a few things, and this is not certainly not an exhaustive list, and I'll go through them individually over the next few slides. But the idea is that we can, if we just look across, we'll have sort of post-perovskite was discovered in 2004. Those are the first papers that we know and love, right? Whereas today, now we have an actual name for the perovskite mineral, right? And for those of you not in the know, right, this magnesium silicate perovskite, which we know as bridgmanite, is the most abundant mineral in the Earth. So this is actually kind of a big deal, not something that we knew that long ago. Okay. So here we go. We've got post-perovskite, and then we have this bridgmanite, which was found in a shocked meteorite. Okay, so that meteorite attained the pressures and temperatures high enough to change the silicate material within it into the Bridgmanite structure. And therefore, since we've been able to find it in nature, we can name it, and it was named after Percy Bridgman. Okay. Okay, so what are the other things that were sort of the ideas that we were thinking about back in 2004? Well, because of this new discovery of post-perovskite, and really it was pretty much hot off the press as we were coming to CIDR. So everyone was trying to figure out what this would mean for the deep Earth. There were some hints, though, from seismology that there probably was some kind of phase transition, but the mineral physicists hadn't measured anything that would have been different. So there was some seismic evidence for a phase transition that well preceded the actual discovery of post-perovskite. But once it was found and the Clapeyron slope was measured, that is the phase boundary between the now named Bridgmanite and its successor post-perovskite, it was found to have this negative Clapeyron slope. And so there were several ways that took this information and looked at how the various geotherms would intersect this phase boundary and what that would mean then seismically. Okay, so we have velocity here, and depending if you had, in this case, a hot core versus a cool core, you could have this phase boundary crossed once, so you'd have perovskite up here, followed by post-perovskite near the core, or if it were a hotter geotherm, you would actually cross that phase boundary twice. And so that would result in a very different looking velocity profile near the core mantle boundary. And you can do that playing with hot or cool cores, or you could play that looking at different geotherms. So if you had a cold slab coming down towards the core mantle boundary versus a hot plume versus just normal mantle, it would all look different seismically, okay, based on this phase transition. So this was a big deal. And we thought that it would basically solve everything about all the sort of all the things that seismologists had been seeing, that this phase would solve everything. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case, and more experiments were found and looking at different compositions and so forth. And there's been quite an extensive body of experiments and ab initio calculations to look at this phase. There have also been dynamic models, so convection models, and most recently, again, looking at this region near the core mantle boundary, okay, looking at how composition can strongly affect what the seismic waves that would go through these regions. Okay, so then we can not just using the post-perovskite phase transition, but also looking at temperature and composition to then be able to say something about ultra-low velocity zones, which are these very small regions here, as compared to the larger, large low shear velocity provinces. What about water? Okay, so water has been a hot topic for quite a while, and it was not too far before the first CIDR meeting, where the water filter model was proposed. And in that, the transition zone was thought to hold quite a lot of water, lots and lots of water. Additionally, some of the lower mantle minerals, here we have ferropericlase or magnesioworcestite, as was the fashion to call it then, and the magnesium silicate perovskite or bridgmanite, okay, was also shown to hold some water, much less water than the transition zone minerals, such as like ringwoodite or wadsleyite. Okay. But there was quite a lot of water, and this was thought, oh gosh, we could have oceans of water, right? Maybe 10 oceans of water within the interior of the Earth. Okay. Now, fast forward to today. Those are still valid ideas, but now there are other hydrogen-bearing phases or possibilities. Perhaps a high-pressure form of FeOOH. And so perhaps you could have hydrogen now, and this is proposed to be even perhaps at the bottom near the core mantle boundary, has a very dense phase that can hold on to some hydrogen. Also, just a few months ago, ICE7, which is a high-pressure form of water, was found as inclusions in diamonds. And in these particular ones, right, there are several examples of high-pressure ICE7 at pressures of the upper mantle, so just above the transition zone. But there are also evidence of ICE7 into the lower mantle. Okay? So this is water as in H2O water, okay, and not just water as in bonded with hydrogen. So there have been, so this then sort of builds on this idea that there's can be quite a lot of water in the deep Earth, and maybe not just in the phases that we're used to talking about. Now, something else that was pretty recent, or was just getting the first measurements of, was the spin transition of iron in Earth-relevant minerals. Okay, so some of the first measurements, so this is by James Badreau and others in 2003. This was of ferroperoclase, or magnesiowoodstite, MgFeO. And here they are looking at the high spin to low spin transition. Okay, so these are the first measurements of that. And there are many measurements in the meantime of MgFeO, various flavors of bridgmanite, Fe203, FeO, probably Fe304. You name it. If it has iron in it, it probably has a phase a spin transition that is associated with it, and it has been looked at since these first measurements. Yeah, Ben.
I didn't know where your mic started.
Okay, sorry to interrupt, but can you, for an ignorant seismologist, can you explain to me what this emitted energy versus intensity has to do with the spin transition?
Yeah, so what they're measuring here is energy. So this is an energy peak. The higher this peak is sort of the fingerprint for the high spin form of iron. So here's how the electrons are situated in high spin iron. Okay, so you fill up, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 electrons to divvy up in each of these energy states. And so you fill all of them all up, and then you have an extra one because there's only 5 energy levels that are available. And so the that extra one will then pair up with this lowermost energy. In the low spin version, however, is those 6 electrons are actually all paired up in the lower energy states. Okay, so this is then reflected in this bump here. Okay, so at low pressures, so at the lowest pressure, these are the circle, the filled in circles. You see, it's the highest peak there, and at the highest pressure, that's now gone away. Okay, so it is they are showing sort of different energy states or energy levels. Yes.
So actually, again, from a very ignorant geodynamics this time, is there a way for having an intermediate state where only one of the 2 electrons on the left went to the low state and not the other one?
Yeah, so it turns out that this spin transition doesn't happen immediately. It doesn't happen goes from this to this in sort of a stepwise manner. And think it's on the next slide, we'll see that there is a sort of a range of where you go from high spin to low spin. Yeah. And that is shown kind of indirectly here. Okay, so we went from this sort of this changing of energy, right, between high spin and low spin, and this actually results in a collapse of the volume. Okay, so the volume of your ferropericlase, as this is an example of. Okay, so that iron now is going to be taking up a little less space than it had been in the high spin version. Okay, so that's going to get a little bit of a collapse in the volume. And this collapse in the volume also results in a softening of the bulk modulus. The bulk modulus is the elastic moduli that that dictates how compressible or incompressible a material is. And so, as shown here, this is bulk modulus versus pressure. So this spin transition is a pressure-induced transition. And so these are some actually quite new measurements here shown in red. And it shows that the bulk modulus actually drops and then kind of recovers as it is going through this spin transition, which is shown here in the shaded part. If you can see that, there's actually a shaded region from about here to here. Okay. And there are also some other experimental data that's also shows a little bit of a drop here, and then the dashed line here is a ab initio calculation. All right. Now, if there was no spin transition, so that's this what looks like a straight line, this solid line here. That's for MgO. So there's no iron. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Is there a kinetic effect to this? I mean, if seismic waves go through, does this instantaneously respond to those pressure changes?
Yeah, so actually this red set of data is one that was collected sort of dynamically, and I haven't actually finished reading the paper because it's not out yet. I only found out about it about this set of data last night. But from what I understand is that they were so these are all done experimentally in a diamond cell, and they were basically pushing the diamond cell, kind of pulsing the diamond cell together, or kind of like this, while increasing the pressure. And so that vibrational frequency is supposed to simulate like a seismic wave going through it. Okay. And then they're doing that as they're increasing the pressure. So they can really test the elasticity or this bulk modulus quite well. Right. Now, there's kinetics definitely involved. I mean, so in terms of temperature, like if we add temperature, I believe these measurements were done at room temperature. But if you increase the temperature, this also sort of spreads out. So this drop here tends to kind of broaden out across the spin transition range. Okay, so there's definitely a temperature effect as well as a pressure effect. I didn't get to finish this part. So this solid line here is for MgO, so there's no iron in it, and therefore doesn't undergo a spin transition. And so it monotonically increases with pressure, as one would expect, okay? So this spin transition is what is making this kind of drop and then increase again. Now, it turns out that not only does the bulk modulus drop, at least in the spin transition range, and as I mentioned before, the volume decreases once you start going into the spin transition. But what has also been measured is a change, a very abrupt change in the melting temperature. So here, the pressure is shown along the vertical axis and depth, the corresponding depth here. Okay. What is found is that as you go down into the mantle, the melting temperature increases, so the melting temperature increases with pressure. This makes sense, As you push something closer together, it takes more heat to pull it apart. Well, goes up, and then it drops. Okay, that melting temperature drops before coming back up again. And this is likely a result of the spin transition as well. Because in this range here, where you have an increase, as you would expect, but then a drop in the melting temperature, this likely also has to do with this idea of a softening during this spin transition. Okay? As your material is easier to compress, okay, it's also easier to break apart and melt. Now, so these are some of the physical properties that have been shown to be affected by the spin transition since the early discoveries of the, or the early measurements of the spin transition itself. Additionally, besides the physical properties, there have also been chemical properties that have been inferred to change because of the spin transition, and that would have to do with the partitioning of iron between the two main phases of the mantle, bridgmanite and ferropericlase. And so this cartoon here shows that at low pressure, the iron prefers to go into the aluminum-bearing bridgmanite, but during the spin transition, okay, that actually reverses and the iron prefers, did I get that right? Sorry. The iron prefers to go into the ferropericlase and then back again. Okay, so you've got this change in element partitioning also that has been linked to the spin transition. There have also been measurements on the electrical conductivity during the spin transition, and this too has been shown to be influenced or been changed. Okay. Other things that were happening.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, where are you, Karen?
This one? Yeah. What about the magnetic moment? Has that been measured during the transition?
That's a good question. Yeah. The magnetic moment?
Of course.
Yeah.
The spin transition is the spin of an electron change. That means the magnetic moment is going to change.
But has it been measured?
There is a measurement at a very low temperature.
Yeah.
That's from paramagnetic to, that's from. So basically, the magnetic moment goes from some value to zero because of the spin transition. Because after spin transition, you can see that. Could you go back to?
Oh yeah.
Because here you said, what is no spin is zero.
Wait, hold on. They want to get you on tape.
Because in the low spin, you can see that the magnetic moment magnetization is zero. And in high spin, for this Fe2+, it's like we have four bond magnetic moment. So it goes from four to zero in principle.
Yeah. Right.
There is a measurement. It's a Peanuts paper by a colleague group. They measure and you can check it out.
Thank you. Okay, so another thing that has that was starting to gain popularity in the early 2000s was trying to measure sort of more natural types of compositions for, in particular, for bridgmanite. Okay. So, and what I mean by that is instead of just measuring MgSiO3, the magnesium end member, or even just MgFeSiO3, so with a little bit of iron in it, people started adding aluminum. Okay? And there was quite a large debate on what does aluminum do to the compressibility of bridgmanite. And eventually it's basically been figured out. Okay, it depends on the coupling mechanism. Okay, so how does aluminum go into the magnesium and silicon sites? Is it in the case of this top one, it's charge coupled, or in the case of the bottom one, are there oxygen vacancies? So this idea of putting aluminum into the bridgmanite had become quite popular. Additionally, could start looking, rather than just at single phases, start looking at multi-phase assemblages. Okay, so looking at bridgmanite and ferropericlase and calcium perovskite together as an assemblage rather than individually. Okay, and what is the interplay between those phases in terms of how the rock itself behaves? Okay. So this started to become in fashion. Now, continuing on to present, it's got even more sophisticated. So now, rather than just thinking about aluminum or multiple phases, we're also thinking about things like oxygen fugacity, or the oxidation state in the mantle. Okay. part of this had been motivated by some work by Kelly and Cottrell, and where they were measuring the ferric iron content of various basalts. And what they found is, depending on where you were with respect to the subduction zone, your ferric iron abundance differed. Okay, so if you were here at the arc, as compared to the mid-ocean ridge, you were being influenced more so by the subducting crust here than you were at this position. And this was changing then the ferric iron content in those samples. Also, from my group, we also looked at how the ferric iron content affected assemblages. Okay, so again, we're looking at multi-phase assemblages that we think are possible mantle compositions. And what we found is that even if you keep the rest of the composition the same amount of silicons and magnesiums, calciums, aluminums, and so forth, same amount of irons, but what you change is the relative abundance of ferric iron, you can actually get a big difference. This shows volume versus pressure between the oxidized, the one that has more ferric iron, as compared to the one that has less ferric iron. And when you have this change in volume, that then influences the density. Okay, so your density is now different for a rock assemblage depending on how much ferric iron it has. So in this case, the more oxidized material was lighter by about 1.5 to 2%. Than its more reduced version of itself. Yes?
So the reduced one, is there iron 2 plus?
Yeah, there's iron 2 plus in both samples.
So can we see the spin transition from there, from here, like the volume?
Yeah, so this is bridgmanite. This is not ferropericlase. And so you don't see any evidence in terms of the decrease in volume that you would find from a spin transition. The spin transition for ferrous bearing bridgmanite doesn't happen so much higher pressures. Now for ferric iron, it does happen sort of in this pressure range. But that is, it's the, there's not enough ferric iron to be able to see that. At least we can't, I don't know if you can see any, there's a lot of data points there, and I don't see any evidence for that. Yeah. But I do see a very big difference between the two different samples that differ in ferric iron abundance. Okay, and then finally for the mantle, melting, right? How do these minerals melt? Okay, so There wasn't a lot of data. Even come the early 2000s, in the early to mid 90s, there were quite a few, and even in the late 80s as well, quite a few measurements of the melting of these two minerals, the bridgmanite and the MgO, the periclase in this case, and the measurements, the temperatures that were recorded, or that were reported, were quite different. Here are some of the measurements on the melting of bridgmanite, and here, in this case, here's MgO, and these measurements here were based off of calculations, and there's a huge variety of values. I mean, you can almost pick your own value, and you might get someone's guess, okay, and what these and what the melting temperatures for these materials are, or were. Now there have been some. There have been many more new measurements since then. And so this is a compilation that came out last year showing some of the melting temperatures of assemblages, so not just a single phase. So now you can measure the solidus and the liquidus of a mixture of these phases, so bridgmanite with some ferropericlase, or even with some calcium perovskite. Okay. And again, depending on the composition, so this one here is for a pyrolite, and this particular sample had quite a lot of water in it, okay, and you see how the solidus is quite low in comparison to all the other measurements. Here in the kind of shaded region was for a chondritic type of mantle, as compared to, say, something that's more pyrolite-like, or it was actually a natural peridotite that's shown here in the brown, so that's the solidus and the liquidus. And then here, the newest data here in blue is for a single phase of bridgmanite, but aluminum and iron bearing. Okay, so these are difficult experiments to perform, or difficult measurements to perform, which is why it's been kind of taken so long. But the data is out there now. But again, quite a lot of scatter. And you've already seen this part too. Okay, so that's the ferropericlase. So before I move out of the mantle, and granted, probably you have your own favorite kind of question about the mantle that has changed in the last decade or so. But are there any questions before I move on to the core?
Okay, so I'm really intrigued by the four diagrams in the upper right because they show a drop in the melting temperature in the mid-mantle, mm-hmm. which from kind of naive scaling would suggest that you would have an increase in seismic attenuation in the mid-mantle, mm-hmm. that you would have a drop in viscosity in the mid-mantle or something like that.
Yes.
What should we take away from this? What should seismologists look for or rule out?
Exactly what you mentioned. Right. So if you look at the paper, and just for space reasons, this definitely influences the rheology, the viscosity of the mantle, and so you will get a similar type of bump, which has been inferred from other geophysical type measurements as you are well aware of.
I guess. From the left to the right, what's changing?
So, yeah, well, so
I have bad
let me
eyes.
Explain. No. So first of all, we have the solidus and liquidus. So the solidus is always going to be the one on the left-hand side. Okay, and then we have different Mg numbers. So this is Mg 75, 80, 85, and 90 for ferropericlase. So that tells you the amount of iron. So this is 25% FeO, This is 10% FU.
And okay. What's the mantle at?
The mantle, this is all sort of reasonable ranges. We can you know, argue about the details, but this is all within the sort of reasonable ranges for ferropericles. Yeah. But despite even changing the composition, they all show this sort of peak here in melting temperature, followed by this drop and sort of a kind of a leveling off before it starts to increase again, after, at least what we infer, after the spin transition is complete. Yeah.
So I guess following Ved's question, a little broader question, what is the mantle adiabat? Because I don't think it's actually reaching those temperatures, is it?
Oh, no, no.
Okay.
So the mantle adiabat, at least currently, is not going to hit any of these. We're not trying to say that the mantle is melted because of this drop. These are still very high temperatures, but in the same sort of idea that it is now sort of easier to melt, okay, this is going to change the viscosity of the material, and that is what is going to be sort of evident. Not that we're going to, you know, we would expect, you know, melt here or anything like that. Not certainly not currently. Okay. Yes.
So I'm interested in that page to show the ferric iron versus of the total iron increasing in the subduction zone. So could you go back to page 15 or 14? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
What is the kind of samples they measure? Does they just pick up some specific crystals to get this conclusion?
Yeah, so there's a number. I don't have any of the figures present on here, but they looked at many tens of samples of you know, from these regions, with respect to, somebody remind me here of the particular subduction zone.
Or so
hold on.
So what they measure was the how much iron 2 and iron 3 is in olivine host and melt inclusions, and also natural quenched glasses. So they make direct measurements of that, basically. And once you know how much iron 2 and iron 3 is there, then you can say something about the state of oxidation. But these are really tiny inclusions. So we're talking about, I don't know what is the scale there like.
Yeah, there's a scale here.
Well, that's a gigantic inclusion, actually.
Yeah.
But you know, generally are 50, 30 microns in size. All right.
Yeah. So, there's the 500 microns. So there's their spot size. I don't know, 50 maybe? Their microzanes spot size?
It doesn't sound that micro to me, but sure.
All right, I can pass this to somebody. I keep it, okay. That way.
Maybe coming back to the melting temperature.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the adiabat doesn't hit the melting temperature at the point of the iron transition. But this iron transition also changes the slope of the melting temperature towards the core mantle boundary, right? So the temperature at the core mantle boundary is much lower in this line than if there wouldn't be an
good
iron
one
transition.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when, like, I mean,
that's not published
we observed
yet,
the ultra low velocity zones at the core mantle boundary, and it was relatively clear that it probably is only possible by melting to reach these seismic velocities. But it was kind of a big deal that we saw this melting. But with these melting temperatures, it's kind of expected. It's nearly impossible to not have melting at the core mantle boundary. Is that kind of a correct interpretation?
That is possible. Yes. Yes, that is possible. The temperatures can be quite low. At the CMB, I was focusing just on here what's actually shown. But if you extrapolate that to the core mantle boundary, then you might have it might be easier to melt. But it would depend. It's highly dependent on composition.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think the other thing to remember is that in addition to the adiabat, you need to think about the boundary layer at the bottom of the mantle. And the
which
temperature
is much,
in the
which,
core
right.
could increase by 1,000 degrees or more.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, what is the temperature at the core mantle boundary, and then what is the gradient there? Yeah. So these very well could intersect.
Yeah, just wanted to make a comment in terms of the viscosity, right? Or, you know, Ved was asking about the signals. At the top, where you see the big sort of effects, that's MgO, right? Mm-hmm. And so then the question becomes, what controls the viscosity of the assemblage? The softest, phase or the strongest phase? And that is not something we know.
That's right.
And therefore, even though you see the, and the spin transition in perovskite is much more in question and the effects are less. So, you know, this is periclase, which is, what, 18, maybe 20% of the mantle? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that it isn't controlling it, but the fact is we don't know.
Right? You're absolutely right, yes. And I mean, and there's the BEAMS model that came out 2 years ago, I think now, would suggest that it's the bridgmanite, right, that is forcing this, making the importance for rheology and so forth.
So you also mentioned that this change in the iron spin state is associated with a change in partitioning of aluminum in the crystal structure. So I'm wondering if there's any sort of, let's say, change in elemental partitioning or something, like an isotopic heterogeneity that could be associated with some of these spin transitions.
For an isotope?
Or some kind of a geochemical signature.
Yeah. So the person who ran the experiments of the element partitioning is sitting right behind you. So I certainly don't want to. he could certainly answer that part of the question better than I.
Just a quick comments.
Yeah.
We do follow up work on that. And the kind of important thing to realize is that there are many geochemical tracers that can have different oxidation state, valence state, and some of them are 4+, like uranium and thorium. They're really important heat generating elements. So from typical experiment we have done in mineral physics where we only concern about 2+, 3+ of iron, it's very difficult to extrapolate what we know to those unusual, from our standpoint, geochemical mm-hmm. tracers, but that's somewhere we probably need a lot of development in the near future. But that's really important next level question, I think.
And I don't talk anything about carbon here, but yeah, I mean, that just throws another wrench into it all. All right, can I move on to the core, at least briefly? Okay, so the mantle has been getting a lot of shine, right? But what about the core? And this is a much shorter list, but that's not reflective of less problems or less questions or less interesting. That's more not enough time on my part to prepare it. But these were some of the things we were worrying about in 2004 and their counterparts today. So let's look at the first one. The big question, right? What's the light element in the core? The core is not just pure iron. And so there have been sort of the common favorites, silicon, oxygen, sulfur, carbon, what have you. This is based on experiments on, these are all various metals. Okay, so here's iron. These are shock measurements on iron. This is what the core would look like, this is what the mantle would look like, and these are elements, okay? So clearly the earth is not, or you know, the mantle is not aluminum, okay? But just showing how mass or density changes with, here this is velocity, okay? And so it was through these sort of early measurements that the core was thought to be, you know, mostly iron, but with some light element, because these are where those p velocities would lay. Now, that's just light elements. So, you know, you could put silicon or oxygen or whatever. But now, as we are learning more about the core and having more seismic measurements and more mineral physics measurements and calculations, the core becomes suddenly much more complicated. Of course, it was always complicated, but it can't just be a single binary system. It's not just going to be iron silicon or iron sulfur or iron oxygen. So a few years ago, Badgerlin and co-authors said that there has to be at least some amount of oxygen, plus then you can pick your favorite, right? You like carbon, that'll work. You like silicon, that'll work. You like sulfur, that'll work too. But you're going to, it requires, the seismic velocities require some amount of oxygen. That's what this paper proposed. Now, a few, just last year, there are another set of measurements. And in this set of measurements, what they found, so they were looking in an iron silicon oxygen system, and what they inferred from their measurements is that SiO2 exsolved from their melt, their iron melt, okay, or precipitated from their iron melt. And so this result, their inference was you can't have both silicon and oxygen in your core because it would immediately kind of go away, okay, and float up to the top. Okay. So that is in contrast to what Badreau was suggesting, where silicon oxygen would be very happy. You know, would be at least seismically happy. Now, fast forward to some more recent results by Sarah Arveson here in the audience, where she has also looked at iron silicon oxygen alloys and melted them. And what she has found is that also at high pressures and high temperatures that you can form two melts. Okay, so you can form two melts that are immiscible. Okay, so a melt that is rich in oxygen, and then a melt that is poor in oxygen. Okay. And so in this case, you could have two immiscible melts that would be, with their densities would be different, and so then you would expect some amount of separation due to the buoyancy changes. Yes? Mike?
So just a simple question for us ignorant folk. What is the pressure of pressures in the core? So core mantle boundary, maybe
not
inner outer
this
core.
This is a little too low. Okay, so the at the core mantle boundary, there's about 136 GPa. Down to the inner core is about 330. Okay, so these pressures here aren't quite as high. This is an example of sort of one of the prettier examples of what we see. Yeah, but good point. Thank you. Yes.
Oh, hello. Yeah. So I've heard it quite a few times, but what exactly is immiscibility?
Ah, okay. So like oil and water? Yeah, so they don't mix. Yeah. Okay, great. So this is sort of a change in, or maybe it's just now we're less stubborn, right? We're not thinking of just binary systems. Now we're moving on to more complicated systems, and you know, a ternary is probably certainly too simple, right? There's like the whole periodic table in the core. So another kind of hot topic back in the early 2000s was the heat budget of the Earth, of the core, and particularly the radioactive heat budget. Okay. And I was trying to find a good image, and I was just like, I'll just get a picture of the really hot core. but the idea that you could put, you know, sort of a lot, or maybe not that much, of potassium, uranium, and thorium, and this is based on work of many, many people. But you know, you could have very little, okay, or you could have a lot, you know, thousands of ppm. This was kind of in fashion, it's cyclical. Back in the 70s, it was in fashion, and then it kind of went out of fashion, and then became in fashion again in the early 2000s, and then it's kind of out of fashion again. so you kind of have to wait if you like these elements, you may have to wait a little while before they become in fashion again. So instead, when we think about heat budgets, we realize you don't really need kind of any radioactivity down there. You can. It doesn't, you know, a little bit doesn't hurt you, but it doesn't really help you much, okay, in the kinds of questions like, you know, how do we form a dynamo? And some of the earliest ideas were that, you know, we needed an inner core to have a dynamo. And so the inner core, we could have it maybe be 2.5 or so billion years. It was really hard to get it, you know, much older, but you know, if you play around with some of the numbers, you could get it to be a little bit older. Now, with, I'm not there yet, sorry. Okay, that's the next two slides. So let's think about some other possible heat sources or energy sources. Okay, so a couple of years ago, it was proposed by O'Rourke and Stevenson that perhaps during the beginning, when the core was formed, it was very hot, and you could put in a little bit of magnesium, say, into this hot molten core. Okay, a little bit of magnesium solid solution into the core. However, as the core cooled, the magnesium or the magnesium minerals, because it's not just magnesium, there might be a little bit of silicon and oxygen and so forth, would start to precipitate out or dissolve out of the molten core. Okay? Now the whole core is molten at this point. Okay? And as it dissolved out, this would give you some buoyant material, which could then mix the core. Okay? So this allows, or this gives you kind of this basically gravitational potential energy to have a dynamo. Okay? It gives you the ability to mix. So you don't need a heat source like radioactive heat source. Okay. So that was proposed. It was also then later shown that in fact, yes, this is, we can show this with experiments. That was done by Badreau and others. By Zhishui Du in the year following this. Okay. And then last year, again, you've seen this picture again, this idea that you can get SiO2 precipitating out of an iron melt, again, giving you a buoyant source to have mixing. Okay. So these are additional energy sources for the core. Oh, I took out those pieces. That's all right. I'm going to end here. It looks like I'm going well over my time. Okay, so for those of you who have not read Francis Birch's paper, 1952 paper, this is one of the kind of the funny things that are put in the paper before he starts going to the nitty-gritty, right? Unwary readers should take warning that ordinary language undergoes modification to a high-pressure form when applied to the interior of the Earth. A few examples of equivalents follow. So if I use the word, or any high-pressure scientist uses the word certain, it's probably more like dubious, undoubtedly, perhaps, positive proof, vague suggestion, an unanswerable argument, or a trivial objection, and if the core is pure iron, well, obviously, that's not going to be the case. Sujoy is going to take the reins from here and continue sort of the motivations. If there are any other questions, otherwise, yes.
So what do you think about the idea that the crystallization of the core buffers temperature at the core mantle boundary?
The crystallization of the core buffers the temperature.
Yeah,
buffers the temperature at the core mantle boundary. Okay, so in order to get heat out of the core, right? If the core is surrounded by a rather insulating mantle, the mantle in large part is holding in a lot of that heat. Now we can push out the heat, but if it's not being reciprocated out, then you have a problem. Now with the crystallization, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but if I think you have to, no, I probably maybe unplug mine. So the crystallization—I forgot. So the crystallization of the core is thought to push out some of these light elements, and so the inner core is thought to have less light elements than the rest of the core, and so you are going to get some, again, gravitational potential energy with the buoyancy of whatever is being sort of spit out as it crystallizes. So is that what you're trying to get at, or
No, but maybe we should talk at the break a little bit more about this with a piece of paper.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
No. I think there's probably a disconnect between the resolution on the display.
Yes, yeah, so if you do like the thing that brings up the screen, the F.
The presenter
F8.
View.
F8 or F something. It brings
it looks
up
like it's
F8. From the display.
Yeah.
But it's F.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. So it says duplicate right now by second screen.
That's okay.
You have cell phone number?
I know.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you, Carolina, for saving the day. So I'll continue on with this theme of relating geochemical and geophysical heterogeneity in the mantle by looking back and then looking at the road ahead. And so I was starting to think, you know, how has our changing, or how has our view of how heterogeneity in the mantle is created changed? And so looking back at 2004, we would talk about creating heterogeneities associated with mantle melting. So here is an image where we have mantle that upwells underneath the ridges. It partially melts. That melting process fractionates elements. Some of the elements end up in the crust. The other elements are in this residue, which becomes part of the lithosphere. And this process has basically generated two different reservoirs, a melt and a residue, or the crust and the residual mantle here. If you have an upwelling plume, that plume doesn't go all the way up to the surface. So it melts at a deeper level. Maybe it interacts with the lithosphere here. And so the chemistry of these erupted melts are different than what's coming up at a place like the mid-ocean ridges. And so this could be yet another reservoir. And then this package is getting subducted down into the mantle. And this process of subduction might end up melting some of the crust here. It might drag sediments down with it. Both the crust and the sediment might dewater, which might produce flux melting off the mantle here, creating yet another reservoir. And then all of this material, or all of this package, is getting down into the mantle. And so these set of processes we can think about broadly as the processes responsible for creating heterogeneity, and what we potentially could observe as either chemical signatures or geophysical signatures in the mantle. The way that these heterogeneities are then destroyed in the mantle is through mixing. And so this is from a paper by Peter van Kieken, where he's showing you two regions in the mantle from a simulation. This part here corresponds to this region, and this upwelling part corresponds to here. And the color is indicating the degree of stretching. So red colors indicate that the material has been stretched a lot. So basically, as the material goes into the mantle, it gets folded, it gets stretched, it gets boudinaged, it gets refolded. And this process leads to basically decreasing the length scale of these heterogeneities. And so in the upwelling region, you can see a lot of the material has been stretched quite a bit. Up here, some of the material or actually gets closer together. So this is basically looking at the tracer particles. So in this case, the tracer particles are closer together than initially before the simulation was started. So this process of stretching and folding is actually what is destroying these heterogeneities. So in the past several years, we have seen remarkable improvements in our ability to image the mantle seismically. And this has, I think, led to quite a shift in the way we think about mantle flow and how that flow affects heterogeneity. And so here is a set of seismic images from a paper by Fukawa and Obayashi in 2013. This is, I believe, shear wave velocities. And what you're seeing is a bunch of slabs, some of which might be stagnating at 660 kilometers, some of which might be going straight down, but a lot of these seem to be stagnating at depths of maybe 660 to 1,000 kilometers, maybe meaning that this slab stagnation is not happening in the transition zone, but it's happening in the uppermost lower mantle. And what these images are telling us is that there is certainly flow between the upper and the lower mantle, but there does not seem to be maybe unfettered flow between the two. Likewise, we think we now have the ability to detect at least some of the major plumes seismically. So this is from a paper by French and Romanowitz. And so again, you're seeing some of these strong plumes as these upwellings. And again, the interesting aspect, or one of the interesting aspects of this particular study was that they were observing that even these upwellings sometimes seem to be deflected at this depth of about 1,000 kilometers. And as geochemists, we have to kind of worry about what this might mean in terms of taking surface observables and mapping it back into the lower mantle, especially if we have flow that moves along the bottom of the uppermost lower mantle. And so roughly at about the same time, Max Rudolph and Ved and Carolina came up with this sort of a updated view of viscosity in the mantle. And in this case, they did not a priori assume any kind of layers. This is a Bayesian approach. This is showing you the degree or the change in viscosity as a function of depth. And these hotter colors are indicating higher probabilities. And so what they are observing here is that the most likely scenario is that the jump in viscosity maybe doesn't happen at the 660 kilometers, but maybe that jump in viscosity somewhere between a factor of 10 and 150 happens roughly at this depth of 1,000 kilometers. And maybe this change, and Kanani was maybe referring to this change might potentially be related to the ion spin transition. But so this, I would say, is not necessarily a fundamentally different view of the viscosity structure, because I think there were studies even in the 1990s that had talked about an increase or a jump in viscosity at a depth of 1,000 kilometers.
Sorry for interrupting so early. Didn't we just talk about the fact that the iron transition should decrease the viscosity?
So here is one example where it decreases it, and then it relates, and then it causes a bump.
Okay, so it kind of increases the viscosity when it's finished.
Yeah, that's right.
Can I just add something?
Sure.
This paper was the direct result of Sider.
Yeah. So all of these three pieces of observation has fundamentally led to a different view of the mantle. And broadly speaking, I would say that these views have made some of the old problems basically go away. So we no longer really talk about a layered mantle convection versus a whole mantle convection. That I think is pretty much resolved.
we pretty much also resolve the fact that the whole lower mantle is not primordial. If you have material going into the lower mantle, then there has to be a return flow out of the lower mantle. And so these cartoons are sort of these n-member scenarios. So this is the layered mantle convection with no communication or very, very little communication. And likewise, this is a cartoon that's showing this whole mantle convection. And I think none of these cartoons are correct, because again, what these seismic observations are telling us is that there is a lot of flow between this upper and the lower mantle, but maybe it is not unfettered flow, meaning that there is some impedance to flow, maybe not at 660, but maybe in sort of this broad region of 660 to 1,000 kilometers. And so maybe more interesting questions to ask now based on these new observations is to sort of figure out, you know, where in between the spectrum is the real mantle lie? Is it closer to this end or is it closer to this end? My personal bias is probably it might be closer towards this end than towards a more layered system. But some of these old problems still remain. So I talked about the fact that the mass flux between the upper and the lower mantle is still an outstanding problem, but it is partially resolved because we know that there is flow. So we are no longer talking about the fact that there is no flow. So back in the 1990s, even we were talking about the fact that plumes were actually generated from boundary layers at the transition zone and not from the CMB. There are some problems that are still outstanding. I won't have a lot of time to talk about it right now. So one of them is the argon paradox, which relates to basically the bulk composition of the Earth. So if you think you know the potassium content, you can figure out how much argon-40 has been made. You know how much argon-40 is in the atmosphere. Based on reasonable estimates, you would say half of the argon-40 is in the atmosphere, the other half is in the mantle, and it turns out that the MORB source just does not have enough argon to balance the other half. And so the original proposition in this paper was that that argon-40 was being stored in the lower mantle in this primordial reservoir. The reason why this is no longer valid is, again, we know it's not a primordial lower mantle, and because our view of the bulk composition of the Earth has changed, meaning that maybe the Earth does not have 280 ppm potassium. These numbers may not mean anything to you right now, but based on new ideas about how to derive Earth composition, the proposition is that there's a lot lower potassium. And really the reason why this has reached a stalemate is because unless you really know the bulk composition of the Earth, you actually don't know whether you have a problem or not. The second is the helium heat paradox. This is actually even older. And the idea is that we know the helium flux out of the mantle pretty well, and most of that is helium-4. Helium-4 is produced by uranium and thorium decay. So there's actually a relationship between generation of radioactive heat and the generation of helium-4. So based on the helium-4 flux, the amount of radiogenic heat that should be associated with that is only on the order of about 2 to 2.5 terawatts. That's about a factor of 4 to 6 lower than the amount of radiogenic heat that we believe is coming out of the mantle. And again, the idea in this paper was that there must be some kind of a boundary layer that's preventing the helium from escaping, whereas heat is diffusing through that boundary layer. And again, initially the idea was this was the upper-lower mantle boundary. Again, we know that that's not valid, but there has not really been a resolution to this problem. And so we have just kind of moved on. We know that there's a problem, but it's unclear how to resolve it. But
is the amount of helium that we get out of the mantle, I guess, commensurate with the uranium, thorium, potassium in the depleted MORB mantle?
No.
It's still too low? Thank you.
Mineral physics beginner
sure.
question. So we know from experiment that some elements can prefer to be in particular crystal structure. So in these pictures that you're talking about, do you assume that the partition coefficient of particular elements in different minerals are pretty much the same throughout the mantle, and that wouldn't play a role at all? I wonder if there's any sort of like particular mineral stable at particular pressure, even if there is a mixing, that mineral is so stubborn to hold these elements that it doesn't let it go. Is that really physically or chemically feasible, or
so
think about that way?
So that's possible. So now the thing to worry about is if you have flow from the deep mantle that's coming up to the surface and that's partially melting, based on the upper mantle assemblages, it appears that at least for helium, helium is highly incompatible in all of them. So even if the mineral is holding on to helium at great depths in the upper mantle, all of the phases appear to be pretty incompatible. And sort of the same is true with argon. The question that you are posing is actually really interesting in terms of thinking about the distribution of not these radiogenic, so these are all radiogenic species, but the non-radiogenic species, how they would be distributed as you, for example, crystallize a magma ocean. Okay. So in addition to a few of these old problems remaining, we now actually talk about a whole set of newer problems, such as what are sort of these reddish features, also known as the large low shear wave velocity provinces. And here you see two of them, one underneath the Pacific and one underneath Africa. And a lot of ocean island volcanism is associated with these features. And the question is, are these primordial features? Are these related to the subducted slabs? Whether all is two of them, there's actually a third one up here called the Perm anomaly. So how and when did these features form? How big they might have been 4 billion years ago? Because if plumes are actually sampling these regions, then back in time, they must have been bigger. Here is a cartoon from a couple of papers, one by Johanna Nemanowitz and the other by Lee et al, that's talking about these features at the base or right at the core mantle boundary, these ultra-low velocity zones. And the questions are, like, are these the remnants of a global magma ocean crystallization? And I'll touch upon this again a little bit later. Or are these melts that are being generated by core mantle reaction zones? And are both these ULVZs and LLSVPs actually expressing themselves in surface observables or surface geochemical observables? And how do we actually test for some of these? So I'm going to just touch upon one study which took a kind of new approach in terms of using surface geochemistry to map back a physical parameter in the mantle, temperature. And so this is a paper by Dalton et al. And so what you're looking at is depth from surface down to about 700 kilometers. And in this case, they're looking at the correlation between shear wave velocity, and I just want you to focus on this blue line, which is the sodium content of the basalts. And what they were observing is that at depths of about 225 to maybe about 400 kilometers, there was a high degree of correlation between the sodium content of the erupted melts and the shear wave velocities. And in this case, the shear wave velocity model is the S40RTS. The bottom panel shows you the expectation between the sodium content and the shear wave velocity anomalies, assuming in this case, if you only have a change in composition but no change in temperature. So these are two calculations. One is at a temperature of 1350 and one is at 1450. And so if the temperature is kept constant and you change the chemistry of the mantle, basically you change the sodium contents with very little change in the velocity. And then the actual observations are sort of these gray dots. And clearly this trend cuts across the gray dots. These set of calculations are, again, using the MELS algorithm to generate or predict what the erupted composition of the MELS should be. And they're using the model of Fowle and Jackson to figure out, as temperature varies, what the shear wave velocities should be in the uppermost part of the mantle. So that's this predicted VS and sodium. So in this case, what Dalton et al. Did was they kept the chemistry fixed, but they changed the mantle potential temperature. And that's the predicted pathway that the erupted melts would take, so that lower temperatures would be associated with higher shear wave velocities and higher sodium contents, and higher temperatures would be associated with lower sodium contents and lower velocities. And the reason why temperature and sodium are related in this way is because sodium is an incompatible element. It wants to go into the melt. And so at higher temperatures, you have a higher degree of melting. And so you end up diluting the concentration of sodium. So that's why the sodium content goes down as the temperature of the mantle goes up. So they use this calibration then to map out what the temperature distribution along the mid-ocean ridges were. And this is basically a map showing that effectively along the ridge, you see something on the order of about maybe 200 degrees variation. And most of this variation appears largely to be related to the input of mantle plumes. And so I think this kind of work, where you're using the geochemistry, the seismology, and potentially using flow models to map some of these into deeper mantle is highly promising and is really, I would say, an outcome of CIDR in terms of getting all of these different communities to talk to each other and understand the strengths and weaknesses of each other's arguments and each other's data sets. Okay, a figure that you either hate or love, depending upon your field. I know I'm kind of running short of time, so I'll kind of do this a little fast. So basically what you're looking at is a isotope diagram. This is neodymium versus strontium. We don't need to worry too much about the numbers right now or what all of these acronyms are. But the question that I would want to pose is, what do you do if you have a hypothesis that fits four isotopes and doesn't fit a fifth? So, you know, there are lots and lots of isotopes. So you can make an argument based on a few of them, and I can always come up with another isotope and say, look, it doesn't agree with your story. So what do? Do you roll your eyes? Or do you say, I have to take you seriously? And I kind of just wanted to poll the audience and see what you would do.
Take them seriously.
Only consider the noble gas. Well, because the others have chemistry, and chemistry's messy.
So does anybody have opinions as to what to do? And so this is not a glib question or kind of, it's actually a really important question to ponder, because you have to actually know what isotope is affected by what set of processes, or what system is affected by what set of processes. So for example, maybe this is not a great example, but let's say you're trying to look at core formation using a system that is not really sensitive or only mildly sensitive to silicate metal segregation. That is not going to tell you the full story against an isotope system that is very strongly affected by silicate metal segregation. So it is always useful to keep in mind what isotope system you want to use to trace a process. Bet.
Sorry, quick question. What is LOND?
I said not to worry about these. We will talk about it. talk about it down the line. For the time being, the only thing I would want to say is that you see these isotope arrays. A lot of these features up, especially on the right-hand part of these diagrams, is associated with recycled material. And just quickly to point out that the reason why recycled material makes this very strong impression on these isotope figures is because even though it's a tiny fraction of the mantle, if you look at the crust is about 50% of the budget of some of these elements. So even a tiny amount of material that is input into the mantle ends up having a profound influence on the budgets of some of these elements. And so these compositions like EM1 and EM2, independent of what they are other than they're recycled, even though they might be present in volumetrically small amounts, they have a very strong influence on trace elements, which means that they may not actually have a very strong influence on the major element chemistry. And that's a challenge in terms of relating, again, seismic observables to some of these geochemistry. So one of the things I'm going to claim here, and people are most welcome to actually debate this, I'm going to claim that we still lack a complete understanding of how to interpret some of these arrays. So often we would interpret, for example, a composition that lies here as a mixture of something that's out here with a mixture of something that's out there. But is that really the way to do it? Can we actually do better? Can we actually get a more realistic understanding of what these arrays mean? Can we actually extract things like the mixing time scale of the mantle, the length scales of heterogeneity in the mantle? And I think the answer is yes, and I'm going to point to two studies that have attempted to do this. And I think the time is right to actually investigate these arrays in these two different kinds of approaches that I'm going to quickly point out. So one is a statistical box model approach that started right about as the 2004 CIDR kicked off and was followed by a later paper in 2007. And in this case, what you're doing is you're generating the crust by depleting the mantle. And so one of the weaknesses in the model is right off the bat, we are not taking into account the lower mantle. So the crust is generated only by depleting the upper mantle. And so what you're doing is you partially melt the mantle, you generate a melt and a residue. These are your two boxes. These boxes can then be added to the crust, or the residue can be put back into the mantle. And now, unlike traditional box models, what happens is that the sizes of these boxes are allowed to change over time. To effectively mimic this concept of stretching and refolding, meaning that as these boxes age, basically the scale of these boxes diminish. And so that's why they're called statistical models, because you start with one box, and at the end of 4.5 billion years, you might have something like 40 or 50,000 boxes, all of different shapes and sizes. And then what you could do is you could basically have a random sampling of your mantle to see what kind of geochemical signatures you would observe. And so here is one set. So in this case, they're effectively generating the continental crust by a 0.5% melting, important for the time being. You're looking at the distribution of neodymium isotope composition as a function of the sampling length scale, and they're fixed the stirring time of the mantle. So if you fix the stirring time, what they're showing is as the length scale of sampling the mantle becomes larger, this is what happens to the distribution of observed isotopic compositions along the ridge system. And so maybe not completely unexpected that as you go to a very large length scale, you basically tend to average out everything and you get a very sharp distribution. As you go to smaller and smaller length scales, you see much more skewed distributions. And so you can actually take this approach to then figure out what kind of stirring time scales and what kind of sampling length scales are required to basically fit our observed isotopic arrays. And here is one example. So this is, I know it's kind of hard to see the actual measured data points, which are up here. And these are kind of the model data points. So this is for mid-ocean rich basalts, and these are for mantle plumes. And basically, they're doing a decent job for the mid-ocean rich basalts, but one of the things you notice is that there's hardly any model data points out in this domain. And so they're unable to reach some of these extreme compositions. And again, maybe not unusual, but I thought this was a great first step in terms of thinking how quantitatively we can extract information about the age of heterogeneities, about the length scales of the heterogeneities, about stirring times in the mantle, and so on. And you can also imagine that you can take realistic rheologies to figure out how the size of these boxes should actually change as a function of time. Now, one of the things that these box models do not do, so they're basically just tracking mass conservation. They're not actually tracking, for example, the thermal evolution, and that's one of the weaknesses of these box models. And so here is another example from a geodynamic model, where you're solving the coupled mass Stokes equation and the heat advection diffusion equation, which does allow you to take into account the thermal evolution of the planet. And so in this case, what you're seeing in the white dots are basically recycled eclogite or recycled crust, which appears to be ponding at the base of the mantle. So you could imagine maybe some of this is related to these LLSVPs, or large low shear velocity provinces. And again, after 4.5 billion years of run, what Brandenburg et al. Did, so student of Peter Van Kicken, they went in and randomly sampled the mantle. And this is, again, the observed distribution of neodymium and strontium isotopes. And this is the model distribution of strontium and neodymium isotopes. And again, what you see is that this is a great first step. You see a lot of variability. So this is basically the ambient mantle up here. And then this is the composition of the material that's sort of in the lower parts or right above the CMB. So one of the things that this model does is it does reach some of these extreme composition. It doesn't necessarily fill out the whole space, but it also seems to be missing this component of sort of the depleted part of the mantle. And I think one of the reasons why that's happening is because in this kind of a simulation, you're predicting too much mixing between the different regions of the mantle. So you're never able to preserve something that looks really depleted. But again, I think we have much better understanding of how to do these kinds of models today than we had about 10 years ago. So before moving on from this, I just want to quickly reiterate the point that the story about the heterogeneities, how they're created, how they're destroyed, and the length scales in the mantle today is contained in these kinds of isotopic diagrams. We still have to actually extract that information. And I'll end with one of the points. So since I am running short of time, maybe I'll skip on the length scales of heterogeneity and talk about what has fundamentally changed in our view, what has fundamentally changed in our view, which is realizing that the mantle has always been heterogeneous, that accretion was a heterogeneous process, the moon-forming giant impact, which we often thought ended up homogenizing any kind of accretional heterogeneity, actually did not homogenize the planet. And so right from the get-go, the mantle was heterogeneous. And I would argue that this is a profound change in our thinking compared to even 10, 12 years ago. And it kind of started with this figure, which I'll talk more about in my later lecture today, of neodymium 142. So this is the composition of the Earth, and basically all of the meteorites are shifted to the left. And I'll talk about how to interpret this later on. But for the time being, I'll just point out that this was used to argue for a very early differentiation event, or the fact that the Earth and the chondrites did not share certain elements such as samarium and neodymium in the same proportions. So this view of the mantle recording an early differentiation with a hidden reservoir, or the silicate mantle having a higher SMND ratio, actually fundamentally affected the way we think about the bulk composition of the planet. Likewise, a couple years after the Boy and Carlson paper on the neodymium 142, LeBros et al. Published this concept of a basal magma ocean. So Kanani showed a adiabat and a liquidus for the mantle. And the idea is if the adiabat intersects the mantle at mid-mantle depths, then basically the magma ocean, instead of crystallizing from the bottom up, would basically crystallize from the mid-mantle up and down. And so what you would end up doing is isolate a basal magma ocean above the core. And in this paper, LeBros et al. Argued that maybe this basal magma ocean is also responsible for this neodymium 142 signal. And then these ULVZs are basically these very last dregs of this basal magma ocean. So as our ability to make some of the measurements, some of the geochemical measurements, as they have improved, we have started to realize that this part or this history is actually still being recorded in rocks. And so that's exciting because it means that we have a way to probe some of these events. And so here is, I know this is a busy figure, and again, I don't want you to necessarily understand everything in this figure, but just to point out, these are tungsten isotopes. These are systems that are only active for the first 60 million years of solar system's history. The bulk composition of the silicate Earth lies along zero, and basically the idea is that when you look at Archean rocks, some of them are shifted away from zero to positive values, also shown up here. In this case, in these komatiites, these are about 2.8 billion years old, and it looks like from this study that by the time modern day rolls around, you no longer see any of these isotopic anomalies. So again, these isotope anomalies were only created in the first 60 million years. They're being observed in rocks that are up to 2.8 billion years old, but not in modern day rocks. That change, or that thinking kind of changed when we started realizing that some of these short-lived isotope anomalies were also being recorded in the modern-day mantle, meaning they were created in the early Earth, but it's still preserved in the modern-day mantle. And so here is an example from xenon isotopes, which are, again, produced from iodine, only active for the first 90 million years of solar system history. And in this case, these are modern mid-ocean rich basalts and modern mantle plumes, and they have different xenon isotope compositions, again, only active for the first 90 million years. And because they're modern-day rocks, you can argue that this is a signature associated with accretion, a heterogeneity associated with accretion, and preserved in the modern-day rocks. And then soon afterwards, we started seeing tungsten isotopes also being preserved in the modern-day rocks. And so here are two studies, one showing positive tungsten, another showing negative tungsten. The negative tungsten anomalies are interesting because this is basically a telltale signature of iron metal. And again, the interesting question is, where in the mantle are you storing this metal signature that you are accessing in modern day rocks? Neodymium-142 anomalies, yet another short-lived system, again active for the first couple hundred million years of solar system, and lots of anomalies in the Hadean and Archean, and basically they seem to have been gone by modern day. And so the interesting time question is, notice there's not a whole lot of measurements here. So on what time scales are these heterogeneities getting mixed away? And the fact that some of these anomalies stay till about 3 billion, 2.8 billion years has actually been used to argue for a stagnant lid regime, because it was thought to be sort of the only mechanism for preventing efficient mixing of very early formed heterogeneities. So the questions to ponder is, what timescales are they disappearing over, and what constraints are these chemical signatures putting on mantle circulation models? So Kanani and I sort of came up with a set of questions that we felt were open-ended. Some of these might be tractable problems, but others are probably things to ponder as we move through the next 4 weeks. So starting off, if it's really true, and I think it is, that the Earth is starting off heterogeneous, none of the box models, none of the geodynamic models have really taken this into account in terms of making predictions for what modern-day isotopic signatures would look like in the upper mantle and the lower mantle. And so if right from the get-go the mantle was heterogeneous, how do you parameterize that? I don't know the answer, but it's something to think about. The second question was related to lab experiments, and maybe Kanani wants to say a couple of quick words on that.
So the idea that if we have immiscibility persisting to the pressures and temperatures of the core, how would we be able to use this information from mineral physics and be able to get better seismic observations or seismic measurements to be able to see this if it's in fact easily visible, say like in the E prime layer. And then what would this effect of immiscibility do on due to convection and dynamo production over the course of Earth history?
So the next question that we had was, what are sort of the energy sources and how have they changed over time? So for example, what is the core's contribution in terms of input of heat into the lowermost mantle? What's the radioactive heat budget for the Earth? These are, I think, questions that are still unclear. How do we map surface geochemical observations into mantle structure and properties? So I gave one example of the work by Dalton and colleagues, but I think that's just the initiation of this approach of relating broad-scale chemistry to observations of seismic properties using flow models. I briefly talked about what we can do to extract information about length scales, mixing time scales from the isotopic zoo. You want to go?
Sure. You want to do the volatiles?
Sure.
Okay. So we can look at also what the volatile budgets are. So this includes water or hydrogen, the noble gases and such, and how do we, you know, what is the communication between the interior of the Earth with the surface, and how does that then influence the habitability of this planet and other planets? We can take that a step further and also look at how the oxidation state of the Earth is, how it changes through time as well as space. So just heterogeneity in both these dimensions, and do these in turn map onto properties in the mantle that we can actually measure? So do these change some of the physical properties that we can measure, say with seismology? And there are lots of other challenges and questions certainly that we'll probably come up with as we go through the next couple of weeks. So.
Yeah, so there are lots of other questions, but I think we're out of space and time.